The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 197 for Monday, April 6th,
2009. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. We're burning out light bulbs. We're running behind.
We're rushing school plays.
We're rushing.
You put me under the gun there.
And I think even Twitter's down. But we are here and we're rocking.
I just thought it was mood lighting, Dave.
That's Pilot Pete, ladies and gentlemen.
We're all back. So
we're back, and it's Monday night. It's like, you know, it's like we're getting the band back together here.
So it's regular. What was I doing?
This podcast is all about regularity.
Well, not really.
Okay, that's right.
So anyways, I was at, very quickly, what was I doing? I was at the Vision Show in Phoenix. Phoenix is cool. Visited a college buddy of mine. The Vision Show was good too, and actually I'll have to dig through my notes, but did learn some things in the vision field. We've talked about this in the Mac world, differentiating USB and FireWire and different interfaces, and learned quite a bit. I took some courses that had to do with real-time applications for visioning, but it also applies to just about any peripheral. Suffice to say, USB takes more work, and FireWire is... But we'll get to it later. So that was cool. My little checklist, places that have free Wi-Fi when I was traveling. Bradley in Connecticut, Phoenix Airport and Las Vegas. And also I think in Atlanta, if you go to the International. But other than that, I mean, it's such a just a wonderful thing when I can use my iPod Touch and not have to break out the computer to Twitter or whatever the heck I want to do. And there are very few airports. Lots of them offer Boingo or whatever the heck it is. And it's just stop it. Come on, please.
I think it's
exhausting enough as it is and stressful enough traveling. Free Wi-Fi would just calm me down.
Is that what it takes? Free Wi-Fi is like the Xanax of the information age. Is that right?
Well, in addition to some other things like having enough seat room and your flight being on time and
these minor details. That's right.
If you're at the airport, doesn't it come to like $300 a month for slow, crappy Wi-Fi?
Yeah, but it's still cheaper than most hotels.
Well, this is true.
My hotel was $12.95 a day, and I expensed it.
Was it good, or was it like being, you know?
No, it was very good. Well, I brought my own. In the interest of some security, I brought my own Airport Express.
Was the bandwidth enough, though? I mean, regardless
absolutely. It was fine. I was streaming movies and slow. No, the
so
speed
you're
was
the guy that slows it down for the rest of us.
Well,
what I got to say
is that this hotel, that this was the Sheraton Phoenix downtown. This hotel is like a year old. This is a new hotel. They're really trying to build the downtown. They just got a new hotel. The convention center is beautiful. I put up some pictures of it. They got a light rail system. But it's funny because as opposed to other cities like San Francisco or Chicago or New York or wherever we go for trade shows, it was kind of dead. I mean, almost like Wall Street, and then we'll move on. But like if you're in Manhattan, I did training one time and it was in the Wall Street area, like, you know, the southernmost part of Manhattan, and it was Deadsville after 5 o'clock. Same sort of thing. Not so much with Phoenix, but anyways, it was a great trip.
I think just to give a shout out there, I've never been there, but PDX, which I believe is Portland, Washington.
Portland West.
Portland, Oregon.
Portland West.
Portland West. Right. Also has free Wi-Fi. So.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good. You know, and while we're on the subject of Portland West, we will do our we'll give a shout out to Gene and we'll segue right in to our first sponsor of the evening, which is Smile on My Mac at smileonmymac.com. Text Expander 2.6 just came out. Now, Text Expander, if you don't know what it is, what they've created here is a piece of software. It runs in the background. It's a preference pane. It's running all the time. And it allows you to type short little snippets that of text that will then be expanded into something much larger. Now, you know, you can use it for something very simple, like an email signature. And though that's very simple and easy to do, man, it saves so much time to do something like that. You can also have it. I have my physical address here, and actually John's physical address, because a lot of times I'm dealing with people and they ask, oh, you know, do you have an address for reviews to go out to? And I used to have to go and look up John's address because I don't have his address memorized. And then I finally put both of our addresses into a little snippet in Text Expander, and I type my little thing, and boom, I type like, you know, comma JB ad, and that's comma John Braun, you know, address is how cool. I remember it. And boom, out comes John's address. No problem. I've got the same thing for me here. It works great. I couldn't possibly imagine living without Text Expander on my Mac. Now, version 2.6, for those of you that are already using it or have seen it in the past, adds a couple of things. You can have groups of snippets, and now you have different expansion options for each group. So you can tell it, look, expand after white space. So after you type, you know, a space, or expand after anything but letters and numbers. So as soon as you hit a period, maybe it'll expand, or you can have it expand after any character. So on a per group basis, you can have different snippets that behave in different ways. You can, and this thing is great. The way it works, and I assume this just because of the way I interact with it. But what happens is when you type one of these things, what Text Expander does is it grabs what's on your clipboard, saves it off to the side, goes and pushes whatever your snippet's going to be into the clipboard, and then pastes it out into your text. Then it goes and replaces the clipboard back with whatever you had out there to begin with. And that delay was sometimes a little bit too much of a lag for people. And so now they've also allowed you to reduce that clipboard restore delay. So if you do a snippet and then hit paste immediately afterwards, you can probably get what you're after. So this is Text Expander from smileonmymac.com. It is $29.95. But of course, you can go get a 30-day fully functioning demo at smileonmymac.com. So that's our first sponsor for the show. And I don't think I said version 6. I think I said version 2.6.
Okay, just checking.
Okay, but sorry. I appreciate you catching me. Yeah. If I did say version 6, it's version 2.6.
I showed it to my 14-year-old son this week. Yeah. He said, cool, I've got to have it, Dad.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Wow. That's right. There you go. $30. Yep.
So a little sideline, Dave. Just, you know, little timely things that we solve here. So this is something I was helping my buddy Josh. You know, okay. He's Mac-based. He's got the time machine and time capsule. And he was like, it's not backing up. It starts to back up, you know, I guess due to the looking at the icon in the menu bar. And then it stops. And I'm like, oh, well, the first place to look is we're going to go to Applications, Utilities, Console. And the first time I asked him, he sent me the whole console, which was bad. You want to filter on the console. Well, no, within a couple hundred lines. I don't think the default view holds that much, but I'm like, nope, find me backup D messages. And of course, console lets you search. You know, first you got to qualify what you want to search for. I think, you know, like all messages or system messages.
Right.
And then you type this in and it brought up an interesting thing. So part of this is kind of like reading tea leaves, the console messages, because you never know really what they're saying. But in this case, I found something where I was like, you know, this is probably the cause of his backup aborting. And it said, indexing a file failed, returned -1136 for blah, 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 the name of the file. Aborting backup because indexing a file failed. But that was enough of an error message, especially the -1136, where I searched online. Now, note, this is a backup D message, Dave, which means at least the backup process is invoking it, not Spotlight, but the searching I did hinted that Spotlight. Now, I don't know if Time Machine or something is invoking Spotlight before it does something, or if the file comes up during the backup process and it says, you know, that hasn't been indexed. It's not clear to me, but it's clear to me that the indexing or Spotlight process is being invoked and is unhappy. What I suggested, or I found online, the solutions were, you know, delete your Spotlight index, which you can do if you go to the Spotlight control panel, system preference, sorry. We're never going to shake that, are we?
No.
And basically there's a private tab in the Spotlight system preference. Drag a drive over there. Now, we're going to mention two things. So one, drag the drive that has the problem over into the private area. Wait a while. I don't know, seconds, a minute, whatever. And then drag it out again. That should recreate the index. There may be other ways to do this, which I don't know off the top of my head.
There's a better way.
Okay, and tell me the better way. This is a way, but go.
That way, if the index is corrupted, that way may not do it. But what I found is I use a command called mdiutil. And I or mdutil. It's mdutil. So it has to be run as root. So you have to write sudo sudo space mdutil space dash capital E, which will erase the index, and then a path to the volume. So if it's your boot drive, it's just space and then slash. If it's another volume, it's space slash volumes slash volume name slash, and then that will do it. So if your drive is called stuff, it's sudo space mdutil space dash capital E space dash slash volume slash stuff. And we'll put a link in the show notes. I think there's a Mac OS X hints article that details that process and puts it all right out in front of you.
The good news is shortly after emailing suggestions on how to do this, I got a message on my answering machine saying it's backing up, John. Thank you. So. But today's point, yeah, you might as well, you know, get down to it and just get rid of the whole thing. But it seems in some cases, you know, it's worth a shot before you muck around with the command line to try and use the built-in capabilities. Though, you know, to get your, you know, geek points, you do want to go to the terminal as much as possible.
Yeah. And there is some relation from what I read. You know, you passed some of this stuff along to me and I did some research on it. And it looks like there's some relation with Spotlight and Time Machine.
It's weird.
The one thing that I came across other people experiencing was that if Spotlight was running on their backup volume.
Oh, that shouldn't be.
No. And it's supposed to add it out to the privacy tab automatically. But it's helpful to make sure of that. And you have to do it when the backup drive is mounted. So while a backup is happening, if you go into system preferences and Spotlight into that privacy spot, then either drag or click the plus sign and go and add the backup store. So, you know, it'll be backup of, you know, your hard drive or something like that. Go ahead and add that to the privacy tab, because what you don't want is Spotlight running on your backup. Now, I know we've heard from some listeners that have actually purposefully pulled it out of there because they want to be able to search their backups. The problem with that is it may work for some. It may work for some for a while, but then it sort of falls apart. So, yeah, that's that.
Okay. You know, I guess next we're going on to Dave, something that is just, you know, universally beloved and enjoyed by all Apple users and Mac users everywhere, which the dock.
Which is the dock. That's right. Yeah. And, it, you know, this started actually with a conversation that I was having with my brother last week. And then.
No, it's his fault.
It is his fault. Yeah. He was asking me about something. And I said, no, I've never done that. And so we went through this whole thing and wound up coming across a couple of doc tips. And I thought, all right, well, that's a good enough foundation here. Let's assemble some doc questions. And I actually posted to Twitter and said, look, anybody with doc questions, send them in. We'll, you know, we'll go through several of them on the show this week. So we can do this a number of different ways. I might as well start where it started, where Matt, my brother, came to me and said, wouldn't it be cool if you had spacers in the dock instead of having all the apps just lined up right next to each other? Is there a way to space them out? And as it turns out, there is. What it is, and this is actually built in.
Well, there's a spacer of sorts. If you look at the dock, to rewind a bit.
There is so, one spacer, but yes. This is what we're talking about here is putting space between, say, your applications on the dock.
Okay, because right now the granularity is to the left are apps, to the right is folders and the trash and other kind of interesting things. And the spacer bar itself does something if you click on it, but we'll get to that in a moment. But
right.
Other than that, that's all you get. But, you're saying there's more?
The idea was, wouldn't it be great to cluster, like, you know, if you have a couple of web browsers or whatever, cluster those together and have a space on either side of them. And then maybe your utility applications, you know, if you get three or four of those that you always keep in the dock.
Okay. Because right? I do that already, but I group them kind of like browsers. And so, you know, that'd be a nice feature to add a little more separation.
A little more, just a little visual cue. Yeah. And so it's a little funky what you do. And we'll point to the Mac OS 10 hints article that does this. There are two commands. One is a command that adds a spacer to the left side of the dock. Another is a command that adds a spacer to the right side. And you go to the terminal, you type one or the other command, or I guess you could do both. And then you have to run kill all dock, and that will kill and then restart the dock. And when the dock comes back, if assuming you've added a space to the left side, it will be to the far right of the left side of the dock. But you can take the spacer and drag it and move it anywhere. And this will persist among reboots and relaunches and all that stuff. If you then want to add another one, you just wash, rinse, repeat, right? Type the command, type kill all dock, and you're good to go. And I'll give you a hint. In the terminal, once you've typed a command and hit return, if you hit the up arrow key, you can scroll through all the previous commands that you've typed. Assuming you're set up as a default, you can turn this off and change the behavior. But on a default install of Mac OS 10, you can scroll up and do that. So once you've typed these two commands, what you're going to do is just hit the up arrow twice to get to the second oldest command and hit return. And then the up arrow twice again, because now that the kill all dock is now the second oldest command. So it's very easy. Once you've typed and pasted this in, you can just sort of you repeat it all day long and then drag these spaces around. And like anything else in the dock, if you want to remove a space, you just take it and drag it out of the dock and boom, away it goes. So it really is, when he started saying it to me, I was like, huh, that could be interesting. And then I did it just as a matter of exercise. And now I love it. It's great. I mean, you could overdo it like anything, but I like it. So, there you have it. Yeah.
And we're talking about the dock. The dock, I don't think I really viewed it positively when I first got OS 10, because there are a number of features. If you go in system preferences to the dock, size, number one, they seem to really go overboard to show off the pretty icons and all the detail. I don't care about that stuff. I keep it small. Likewise, magnification, that's pretty eye candy for maybe the first 5 minutes, at least to me. Then it gets kind of old. So position on screen, I'm traditional. I do the bottom. But you can do left or right. If you have a screen that can accommodate it, that may be a better thing. And then minimize using, the Genie effect, it doesn't consume all processor, but it's, expensive. And then now I don't know about you. We talked about this before, but animate opening applications, where if something's opening, it does the bouncy thing. I think I still like that, because so it does take, processor to do that. But I think it's probably a good indication. I think actually has some listeners indicated, if it bounces and then stops, that's a sign that something is horribly wrong. So I don't know if you activate that or not.
Yeah, no, I like the bouncing for sure. I think that can be very handy.
Last thing is the auto hide and show. Now, I don't know what you do. We have had some people, and we'll have a hint in a moment, but normally I keep that off. I always like to have it there, and it seems most apps respect that space and don't overwrite it.
Yep, I agree. I like having the dock there. It's a quick, easy way to switch between from application to application. I want to mention, you were talking about how to use the settings for the dock to turn on the Genie effect, or whether or not to animate opening. If you use Onyx, O-N-Y-X, now normally when we're talking about Onyx, we're talking about the maintenance utilities built into this software that it'll clean your caches. And I'm sure we'll talk about that again in this show, because it seems like we always do. And it will allow you to rebuild your permissions and run all the system maintenance scripts and all that stuff. But there is the parameters section, and there's a whole sheet dedicated to the dock. Now, you can alter the dock's appearance from the 3D effect to a 2D effect with a transparency. So going back to the old way, the tiger way, there are three minimize effects. And I believe the dock preferences in Leopard show two, Genie and Scale. They have another one called Suck, which will do exactly what it sounds like. It sucks it back down into the dock. you can, you've got the three positions. So Onyx doesn't allow you to put the dock at the top. I think I've seen something that does, but it'll let you do bottom, left, and right. Mm-hmm. But then it will let you anchor the dock. By default, it's centered. You can have it anchored left, anchored right, anchored top, anchored bottom, depending on how you've done that. So there's some, there's very, very interesting stuff that goes on there. You can set it to go transparent for hidden applications. There's all kinds of little cool little things in the dock. And actually, you know what? Now that I'm looking at this in Onyx, you don't have to do the terminal command. There's a spot right in here to add spacers to the application side or to the other side of the dock. So you can do it all right here. And I had no idea that it was there until just this moment. So there you go. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so Onyx, very, very cool. And of course, it's, you know, well worth the price of admission at free. Yeah. We like free. Free is good. You know, one of my favorite things to do with the dock, John, is to take my applications folder and drag it down into the dock.
Why would you do that?
Onto the right side. No, it's great. It gives
Why?
You... Because it gives you a great way to launch apps. If you don't, you know, you can't do hierarchical app trees in the dock, right? On the left-hand side, it's icon and that's it, you know. But so I put my favorite stuff over there. But then on the right, I put my applications folder. And that way, I have a quick way of launching anything that's sitting there in my apps folder. Now, I don't like it to be in that fan, you know, hoity-toity thing. So I always right-click after I drag the folder down there. I right-click on it and I say open it as a folder and open it as a list. I don't want a group of icons. I just want an alphabetical list and boom.
And it works great. Okay, because I was just messing with that. And yes, my downloads folder explodes into the folder explosion.
Yeah, nobody likes that.
But my documents folder opens up into a traditional you know, file layout.
Yeah, so you can.
So you're saying right click and yeah, okay. Fan grid list automatic. Nice.
Automatic is usually automatically exactly what you don't want. So I think that's what that translates to. It's just, you know, short. It's like code for try and figure out what I want and give me something else at random. That's right.
What next?
All right, should we go to Michael?
Okay.
All right, let me see if I can find Michael's question. Right? Is that right? Is that what we're doing? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hey, John and Dave. Michael from New York. I have a little stumper here. I have a client who is a recent switcher, and he likes to work in Photoshop on the Mac and then do everything else in Parallels because that's how he's used to working. But when he works in Photoshop, he wants to be able to edit his photos full screen, but he doesn't want the dock to appear in Photoshop. Is there a way to tell Leopard that you can only run the dock in Finder mode, or put it another way, I don't want the dock to appear in Photoshop only. So, like a hide the dock based on application type of thing. All right, let's see if someone out there might be able to assist with this. I haven't been able to locate anything useful. This is where you cut me off.
All right. So, John, of course, we go back to our favorite site for little tips and hints and all that stuff that Rob Griffiths produces. That's macOS10hints.com. And of course,
because otherwise you would be ripping your hair out.
I think so. Yeah.
Or banging your head. Yeah. It'd be bad.
It would be
it's
bad.
It's not obvious.
I'd have a bruise on my forehead is what it would be. Yeah. Auto hide the dock on and menu bar on a per app basis. So, there is a hint. It talks about how to do this. What you have to do is first and foremost, make a copy of the application. I'm waiting. Okay, you're done. Good. Mm-hmm. Now, you go into the application, you right click on it or control click on it. You have to show package contents and dig in there. and you'll find an info.plist file, and you go in and alphabetically in the keys, you add another key that is, and we'll send you the hint. You don't have to write this down, but I'll just say it because it'll let you know how deep you've got to go. You're adding a key that is LSUI presentation mode, and you are setting it to mode 4. And then this turns off both the menu bar and the dock. Now, it doesn't turn them off. It hides them. So the menu bar is just like the dock. If you float up to the top, it will float down at you. So for something like Photoshop, this might actually be very, very handy. And they talk about that right in the hint. So so I think it works just fine. But really, make a copy of the app. You don't want to start editing this stuff and screw it up. You've got to edit a plist file. Now, John, I think we're going to talk about it later, but we might as well talk
now.
About it now. Yeah. What's your, anytime I edit plist files, I use BBEdit. And the cool thing about it is you have the option of installing a BBEdit command line utility. So if you're digging around in the terminal and you say, ooh, I want to edit this file in BBEdit, you simply type BBEdit space and then the name of the file, and it opens in the GUI version of BBEdit, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
And BBEdit will edit plists, but there's another way.
Yeah. So plist file. So as you said, Dave, is an XML file, which really is just a text file like HTML or anything that has certain characters that surround the name of the type of data, you know, title, head, whatever. Look at the source for our webpage and you'll see it. But a property list file is a special file, and there are a number of things that can edit it. I think Internet Explorer, well, at least on Windows, not on the Mac, sorry. I think Firefox.
Edit with IE, can you? Or Firefox?
No, I'm sorry, Vue.
Okay.
Typically Vue.
Okay.
But one of the applications that if you are a developer or have installed developer tools is called, not surprisingly, Property List Editor. And what I have on my machine in developer applications, utilities, Property List Editor is a utility that when I double click on a .plist file, that's what it launches. So that's... hey, it's free. Go to ADC, get the tools, Xcode. That's one of the tools built in. And they have a lot of other good tools. Like the other one I like is they have a USB probing tool that tells you everything about every USB device on your machine. And there's a lot of other good tools for free. Sign up on ADC, check it out. So that's what I use. And you use BBEdit for the most part.
Well, yeah, I use it. Let's put it this way.
Or is that your default? I guess
it is. I use BBEdit for a lot of things. If I didn't already have BBEdit on my machine, I would use something else, obviously. But BBEdit is great for editing this stuff. I mean, it treats it just like any other code file. You can fold up different sections of the XML if you want to edit different things. It's really, it's cool. It edits it in a very smart way, but I think Property List Editor does some cool stuff too. So, are we ready to go on to Michael? And this is first you're going to wonder why this is in the doc section, but then we'll get there. So Michael writes, I have a weird little annoyance. I have the weather in my dashboard, but don't go into the dashboard very often. For a long time, I don't know why I said often. I never say often, John. I usually say often.
Often you do.
Often? I do. Yeah. Often I say often.
I think it should be off 10. There's a T in there, right?
There is. Yeah. Yeah. It depends
what's
on.
What's up?
Yeah. So anyway, don't go into the dashboard regularly. For a long time, I would notice that every now and then it would apparently vanish, and I would dutifully re-add it, and recently realized that it was actually creeping up the screen maybe once a day, maybe when it updates. Two questions. One, how do I stop this? And two, do I have a whole bunch of extra weather widgets off the top of my screen hogging my resources? All right. So this is an interesting thing. You might just have a whole lot of weather widgets at the top, because you can put multiple instances of the weather widget in for, say, different locations or, whatever you want to do. Back to the plist editor, John. Home, library, preferences, and then com.apple.dashboard.plist, not dashboard.client.plist. In this case, it's just dashboard.plist. And in there, you'll see all of the widgets. And I was able to add multiple weather widgets. And as soon as I had two added, I saw it doing exactly what Michael describes. Each time it relaunched, it would creep up. You know, it wasn't one pixel, but it was several sets of pixels, and they would both just sort of march on up the screen. On each
so you're
once.
Saying, so when two, more than one instance of the app was active, this behavior occurred.
Yeah. Now you won't see this.
I'm wondering if the app did not expect to see another correct. One of itself yeah. running. And so, and I think we're thinking the same thing. The programmer, for whatever reason, did not check for this condition to say, hey, you know, if I'm opening the PLUS file and if somebody else comes along, tell them to get lost. Not
right.
So it sounds like the two apps are fighting over it, and they're kind of, yeah, they're doing the creeping pixel thing. That's really kind of weird.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, because the at least as far as Activity Monitor goes, it doesn't launch a separate process for each of these things, at least not as far as I could tell. They all live within Dashboard Client, but killing off Dashboard Client does not reload this plist file. So you have to go in there and you'll find key sets. And Michael, you're going to look for the ones that say dashboard, and then you delete the whole key. You'll see it in there, and the way you'll know the key has ended is because you'll see the start of the next key for, say, either weather or you know, maybe stocks or something, and it should be pretty clear that XML is usually broken out in a way that makes it visually apparent what's together. Everything within the key will be tabbed in, so you'll sort of see a hierarchy in an outline there, and so you delete this stuff. And then again, the way you fix it, or the way you implement or institute the fix, is back to the terminal and then kill all doc. And when you're doing the kill all doc command, everything is lowercase except for the D. So it's kill all space capital D doc. And that should do it for you. That should clear that out and save up your resources. But from what I've seen, John, if you don't use the dashboard regularly, it only loads the dashboard after the first time you load it in a session. So if you reboot and you haven't clicked on the dashboard icon, I don't think it goes and refreshes all that stuff that's out there. I could be wrong about this, but it certainly seems like that.
Yeah, I don't pay a lot of attention. Now, a little side question.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the horrible line through the icon thing in the dock.
No.
No, or question mark. I'm sorry. The question mark through the icon.
I have one right now. Yeah.
Which means I believe, hey, what happened to the thing I saw before?
Right.
What'd you do to that? And I don't believe there's a way to resolve that normally.
Well, it depends. In many cases, if the app is restored, app or item is restored, it will automatically fix that when you click on it the first time. In fact, I just did it. I had my Drobo, which is sitting out on the network, was showing a question mark, presumably because it didn't reattach or something, and I have a link to it in the doc. But I clicked it, and it reattached, and now everything's okay.
Good.
That's right. So, you know, the world is at peace again.
In balance. Good. What's next?
We have to do more?
We could, we could just bow out gracefully.
No. Grace is not our middle name. At least it's not mine. Is it yours? Pete, your middle name's not Grace, is it?
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's any. Okay. I just don't know how to segue out of that.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's good. It's good to stumble every now and then. It keeps us honest. That way, this was an example. See, we set this up for you. This was an example of our way of showing you that this show is actually, though you're hearing it recorded, you are hearing it live. There are no edits here, because if there were edits, we would have edited that out. Nobody in their right mind would bother editing a podcast and not cut that little bit out, or even this, what I'm saying right now. But
so
we
don't. Do
we're Dave, we're trying to keep it real.
We're keeping it real. Oh, we've been keeping it real for 3 years now. right? Almost 3 years. We started this show in June. No, 4 years.
No, and I got to say, I don't know what that means because the cool kids know what keeping it real is. I'm just sound cool.
But you're a scant three shows away from 200.
From 200. And I think it's 4 years, right? Yeah, because we started this in 05. Yeet. So, yeah, we're pushing 4 years on this. Keeping it real for 4 years. And there's some hand sign we can make that like, you know, adds an exclamation
point.
It'll
get you shot in some cities.
That's true. That's right. Our second sponsor for the show. We do certainly appreciate all of our sponsors bearing with us through all of that and all
thick
of this.
And thin.
Yeah, it's all thick. It's just, you know, how tough do you want to navigate? It's Circus Ponies at circusponies.com with Notebook version 3.0. We've talked about this before. In fact, we've got a dedicated Notebook user sitting to my right. And no. It's a little bit closer than that, Pete. It's you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. You and your son use Notebook. So it is exactly what it says it is. It's an electronic notebook. It's actually an application in which you can create multiple electronic notebooks and you can have them it's ultimate flexibility because you can create them for any purpose you want and organize them in any way you want. I assume that's right. And you can put, not only can you put text in there, but you can put images, you can put PDFs, you can mark up the PDFs, you can mark up the notebook. You can scan things in. I think it's got some OCR stuff that'll let you mess with the text in there, and it's got a search feature that they call Multidex that allows you to search based on what you remember about an item that you put in the notebook. So you don't have to remember a title. You can just anything you want, a date, a name, anything. And out you go. Is that
exactly? Yeah.
Okay.
You can go for one or two keywords and find an article or something that you've written and you want to go back to and you have no idea where you left it. And that's the beauty of Notebook. It's okay. Kind of like an aid.
Okay.
Get you back to where you need to be.
It's one of these apps that sounds like, you know, we always say, well, you could organize it for different projects at work or this, that, and the other thing. But you wind up using it at home. Your son actually uses it for school, if I remember correctly.
He has three different subjects in it right now.
And
just got to be on a science project when it's all in notebooks.
Hey.
Woohoo.
All right. Look at that. That's right.
Tried to kick it and screaming through that one, but he did it.
Well, that's whatever it takes, right?
That's right.
That's Notebook from circusponies.com. It is $49.95, but as with, I think, just about every piece of software we talk about here on the show, it comes with a test drive. This is a 30-day free test drive, full-featured, so you can use it. You can get your stuff in there, and then you won't have any option but to pay the $50, and you'll be happy about it, and your life will be more complete with it. So that's circusponies.com, Notebook version 3.0, and... I think it's time for Cool Stuff Found. We've been delaying these for multiple shows now, haven't we?
Hit it.
Okay, so this one's actually pretty quick. John writes, not you, but John from Oregon. You're not in Oregon, are you?
Not today.
Okay. Did you write this when you were in Oregon?
No.
Okay. Then John in Oregon writes, I just wanted to comment on something you mentioned in show number 190 concerning iDisk's inability to share individual files the way you can in Dropbox. You can now send links via email for individual large files to be downloaded from iDisk. The link can be given an expiration date as well as password protection. The file cannot be larger than 1 gigabyte, and you will only see this as a small message when you actually click the upload file button in MobileMe. For some reason, Apple announced this last month very quietly. Hope this helps out some of those who may have MobileMe and are unaware they have this ability. And we did. We talked about iDisk's inability to do this. And then I think about 2 weeks later, they finally rolled it out. So thank you very much, John, for reminding us to mention it here in the show so that faithful listeners will not be led astray. We always like to follow up when things change or simply when we get it wrong. And in this case, it was the former. But thank you very much, John. Do you have anything to add to that? John, did we lose you?
He's gone.
He really is gone. All right. You know what? I'm going to pause the show, and then magically, John will be back right now.
I'm back.
Yes, you are. Excellent. Okay, so you probably didn't hear all of the conversation on the MobileMe single file iDisk sharing, but you know what we were talking about. Do you have anything to add to that?
The only thing is one thing I've used as of late, which I really, really like, and it's platform independent, and they have dedicated clients, is usendit.com.
Yeah.
I think you've used it. I've used it just to, similar to iDisk. It kind of lets you... it lets you in securely if you're using a secure browser with HTTPS. You can securely, in a sense, though, don't shake your fist at me if you're a security expert, because, yes, one part of it is encrypting the data stream. There are other security aspects, but it's a handy thing to move files around. So I like it. You like it. They have, like at work, we use Outlook. They have an Outlook plugin. They have a plugin for a lot of different browsers and programs. Photoshop, I think, and stuff like that. So anyways, they don't pay us to say that. Maybe they should. Let's move on.
Yeah, actually, no, let's hang on to that branch for a minute. I do. I use YouSendIt at least once a week. When we finish the podcast, I use YouSendIt to send that file off to Michael Johnston so that he can convert it to AAC. Mm-hmm. And since we started using YouSendIt, other options have become available, a la iDisk or even Dropbox. I guess I've stuck with YouSendIt because it's part of our workflow, and it generates that email to Michael, which is sort of the trigger for him to do that. And then the file just goes away when we're done, as opposed to it lingering out in the Dropbox and someone having to remember, oh yeah, I got to go delete that, you know? So yeah, for that purpose, it's great. You know, if you've got a file you need to send to somebody, bam, off you go, you know, especially if your email provider, like, I was talking to poor Harry at the musical at school tonight.
Poor Harry.
Well, he said his email provider is limiting them to like 7 or 8 megabyte attachments, which is totally unacceptable if you ask me. So,
especially in this day and age.
Yeah, that was great 10 years
megabytes?
Ago.
Megabytes? Well, on the other hand, email is...
Yeah.
I got to push back. Email is not meant as a file transfer solution. It was never meant to be that.
Yeah.
It's been cobbled and twisted to do that, but you really should use something else. So
yeah,
anyways,
yeah, it's true. All right, one more from Matt, a different Matt. I'll find it. Talk amongst yourselves. Oh, I already found it. Matt writes, he said, I was listening to episode 192, I think, and heard the story about the people who got to the store to change the region code on their DVD player. This made me realize that this wasn't a hardware setting, and a few Google searches later, I had the procedure to change my Region 1 DVD player to any region code I desired. Of course, I chose region free. The key to this was the site videohelp.com. They have a section called DVD hacks that can be searched for a particular model of DVD player. Then you just might find the procedure to change the region coding on yours. This might help someone play their content. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, that's handy. A little off the beaten path for us, but...
Yeah, there's still this tug of war between content owners and selling in foreign markets and, you know, them being too cheap or too expensive. I don't know.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, trying to legislate this stuff, it's like, you know, just fix the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So, let's see, we have heard tonight from Matt and John and Michael. Well, that's
my
interesting.
Goodness.
Isn't that weird? And yeah, we have another John coming.
What?
In the next question. So we've had a lot of duplicate names happening here, but they've all found ways to contact us. But how about if you want to contact us? How do they do that, John?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I would think option one is call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is, Dave?
4335.
And you could probably email us.
That's
at,
right.
I think it's feedback@macgeekgab.com. What is it?
You think right. It is feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab if you dare. And... that's really the best ways to get in touch with us. We love it when you post iTunes comments. That's great. It's not not a way to get your comment into the show, but we do love it. And actually, current and future listeners appreciate your comments out there too, because it helps them decide if this is the show for them. And that's a good thing. Yep. All right. So, speaking back to that, that magic phone number, John actually called in, using that number and said,
"Hi guys, this is John from Menominee Falls. I've called a couple of other times in the past. I have a client, who is having a problem with her Apple Mail. She uses Roadrunner for her IP internet service and her ISP. And she connects to her network via wireless, and I set that all up for her. What seems to happen is every once in a while she'll call me and she'll tell me that she cannot send emails. So she loses a connection to the outbound server. And I'll go to her house and I'll reset it up and it'll seem to work okay. And she says that what seems to be happening is that every once in a while she will connect to her neighbor's wireless router, and after that she cannot send email anymore. So I'm looking for two things. One, how can I prevent her from connecting to her neighbor's wireless router? And two, is there anything that else that sounds kind of screwy about this situation that might help me troubleshoot? There's where you cut me off.
John, this sounds awfully familiar.
And it does when we talked about it, but we'll go over it again. So yeah, where you want to look to prevent these you know, mind-numbing problems here is probably system preferences, network, if you're connected on airport. Now, on the initial screen, you will see a checkbox, ask to join new networks. Keep that checked. But then you will also see an advanced button. In the advanced button, there are several tabs on the top. Do the airport tab. And one of them says, remember any network this computer has joined. Uncheck that box. As far as I can tell, that is checked by default. Now, also, you will see a list of preferred networks, which is all of the crud that you've probably picked up while you've been traveling. Look for that list. Nuke anything that you don't recognize, because it may hook up to that again. And I would say the combination of those two things, Dave, would probably keep you in a pretty good, predictable state.
Yeah, I actually would agree. I mean, that's what, you know, this is very similar, of course, to the issues that the woman that I went to help locally here was having with grabbing the other printer, right? I mean, it was the same thing. Now, in this case, it's very interesting because it means her neighbor has a wireless network and yet has a different internet service provider. Because if she had the same internet service provider, this issue would not happen, right? Because the mail server would be the same regardless of which house she was at. So just, you know, makes it more curious, but same problem.
Yeah, or they may have a different mail server. Sometimes I've seen this, you know, your A through M, your SMTP 1 dot blah, blah, dot blah, blah, though. I don't know if people really... Yeah, it's not worth doing that.
Can't imagine.
No, you may. No, imagine, dude.
Yeah.
There are people out there that are doing what, you know, we were cobbling together, you know, tens of years ago.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's true. You know, thank goodness I don't have to put bangs in my emails to you to tell the computers how to route from my computer to yours. Remember those days?
Oh, bang path, yeah.
Bang path.
Right. Yeah. Never mind.
Yeah,
stop.
That's right, never mind. We just all of a sudden went from very helpful to extremely geeky and unhelpful.
If you know what we said, we have pity on your soul.
Hey, those were good days, man. I'll never forget the first time. I know I'm on a tangent here, but you know, I had an account on two different, I had accounts on two different Unix machines. And when they, you know, one of them introduced this support, it was like, oh, cool. So I went in and I logged into one and I typed, you know, my path to the other one, bang this computer, bang that, bang this, and then bang, you know, Dave, boom, here. And then I logged into the other one and I got two emails. And I think I've talked about this on the show before. So the first one,
yeah,
sure enough, was the one from myself on the other machine, and the second was the one from the system administrator saying, please don't waste internet bandwidth by sending an email to yourself from another computer. If only everyone in the world had gotten a very minor slap on the wrist for wasting internet bandwidth with email, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today.
Right. Now, what you said also, to back up a bit, you said bang.
Yes.
Oh. I will say exclamation point.
That's right. Yes. For those of you that...
So old, ancient, archaic Dave mode email address, and me too, would have an I think it was called BitNet, to really go back and, hello, Scott. We know Scott is listening to this, and Scott's been there, Scott Barman, our pal.
Yeah.
I know he's done this stuff, and he will, no doubt, I think, give us a little, capsule.
Yeah, it was, I don't know
what it was like back
BitNet,
then.
Because it was UUCP, right?
Yeah, whatever. All these acronyms, but before it was the internet, it was a mess.
I like that. Dismiss the correction as, oh, it's just acronyms. It doesn't matter. I like that. That was good. That's actually really well done. But yeah, the way it would work is your username, like for example, my email address, right, or the email address to the show right now would be MacGeekGab!!! feedback, right? But that wasn't enough. You had to know what path would get you from your computer to the Mac Geek Gab computer. So, you know, it might
be. So the router sucked.
Yeah, you had problem. To. You, yeah, that's right.
Here's the path from this computer to that computer to that computer.
Yep.
And yeah, and it was just not the way it was meant to be.
And so, the path would be, if let's say you're on Comcast, so it would be, bang. And of course, this Comcast didn't exist in terms of routing email, but it would be, bang Comcast, bang, AOL, if we had to route through their machine, bang MacGeek, bang feedback. And so it would say, go here, go here, go here, go here. And when you get there, go there, and boom, it would work if you took the right path. And if it didn't, it would either disappear into the ether, or it would come back anyway. Back to John's question.
Wow. What?
Did I gloss over something? I thought I did really well there. An alternative would be to use a different outbound email server. Right now your friend is using the email server that her ISP has set up and provided for her. But of course, you can only use that email server if you're connected to that ISP's network. If you take that machine and go somewhere else, it's not going to work. There is good reason then to use a third party email server that allows secure sending from anywhere. And the most ubiquitous of those these days is Gmail. If you go and get a Gmail account, you can then use Gmail's outbound SMTP server in a secure way. You have to authenticate to use it, so you can't spam through it. But of course, a spammer could go and get an account. But your account is secure. And then that way, even if she does happen to pick up the neighbor's wireless network, at least she can still send email. Of course, she may not know that she's picked up the neighbor's wireless network. So perhaps this is a good fail safe for that. But I mentioned it anyway. And that way it would at least solve that symptom of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the problem is that the default settings lend themselves to you. Assuming you may have a couple of access points kind of kicking around the house, and you're not really sure which one to use. So when you get out of range of one, it says, hey, you want me to connect to this other? And you're like, okay.
Yeah. That's
right. May not be, I would say and we actually had our friend, we'll give a shout out to Noel. Right,
yeah. Dave? That was interesting.
One of the old Connecticut, high school crowd.
High school for you. I actually met Noel when he and my mother worked at the same school together.
Oh, yes. DCYS and all that fun stuff,
right? It was
right?
called the Learning Community, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So he actually wrote in about number one, I think he's in Pennsylvania. And I guess you and I assume, living in coastal areas that Wi-Fi is ubiquitous. It's not.
Or broadband in general. He doesn't.
On the coasts. Yes.
He doesn't have the ability to get broadband to his house, so he's having to do long-haul Wi-Fi is what he's looking into.
Right. And so I guess him and his, I think, cousin or brother are exploring. And actually, Noel, he was part of the whole radio crowd that I was part of. Right. So he has some mad skills in antenna design and stuff like that because, you know, you got a signal, you transmit, you receive. If you get the two antennas in sync, and there's a lot of work in this. You've seen the thing, which is kind of funny. A Pringles can is a perfect 2.4 gigahertz conduit. And I've seen people do long haul 802.11 at 2.4 gigahertz with a Pringles can and some other, you know, kind of not very high tech stuff. So it's a very interesting field of exploration, especially for people like him and I. And you probably did a little bit of work with radios.
Oh, yeah.
Then, right.
Yeah. It came from a long line of ham operators. Yeah.
Yeah. Your dad, I think, did amateur radio.
My grandfather and my uncle and all those people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. So anyways, so in the sticks, yeah, you got open space, you got an antenna, you got a transmitter, go for it. Have fun.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of times it's sent over microwave is the way it's done with dishes. I don't know if the Pringles can will go quite as far. You know, I think there's people doing like 5 mile runs of Wi-Fi. And what happens is you'll get an ISP that says, yeah, OK, I'll set this up in the, you know, out here in the country. And then it becomes a network. So, you know, if you're on the network, John, and you've got the signal from the ISP, then they might come to your house and say, OK, we're going to put another repeater at your place mm-hmm. so that you can repeat the signal to me. And then maybe I'd repeat it to Pete and, you know, and all that stuff and bounce it around. So it's definitely pretty cool. And I knew some people outside of Austin, not too far outside of Austin, that were doing this not mm-hmm. that long ago, you know, maybe 5 years ago. It works.
So what I'm going to say is if you're one of our listeners and you're in middle America and you're anywhere beyond, telegraph key, as far as your dad, I'm sorry. People just stopped us. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
I'm trying to think of what it's called. It's, you know, long haul Wi-Fi is the common name for it. But I'm trying to think of what you would want to search for.
Just Wi-Fi, long distance. I don't know. But no, I'm the comment I made the last time I traveled to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which I know one of our listeners at least is there. I was in a hotel and I could not even get telephone modem connections. It was bad.
Wow.
Now, again, it was like 5 years ago and it could have been just been an oddball area of town, though. Surprisingly, later in the evening when we came back from an event for ISO, International Standards Organization event. The SWAT team was out because they heard a gunshot in city limits, which was just like,
All right. So now okay. now
we're going to move on to tangent, something relevant.
The tangent has run its course.
It
long range Wi-Fi would be the other thing to search for if you're someone that's looking for this. Okay. This is somewhat related to sort of related to what we've been talking about. Ryan, I'm jumping all the way to Ryan. Ryan says, I have a MacBook Pro Core Duo, Rev A, and I run the latest Leopard. I use remote desktop connection from Microsoft at work for terminal services, as well as a printer on the same local network in my office. This has been working just fine for me for over a year. 2 days ago, however, I started seeing really odd behavior when I launched RDC. Normally, it bounces once in the dock and initiates the connection to the terminal server immediately. For the last 2 days, when it launches, it bounces, then hangs, then causes all the other apps to hang, and basically chokes Leopard to death. Eventually, after a few minutes, it will display the connection window, then hang again, all the while rendering other apps unusable. Eventually, it connects and then runs as normal. I have no issues using the software on the server, and the only time RDC hangs is when I launch it or when I attempt to change preferences. Similarly, when I attempt to print on the network, the Canon printer app launches and does the same thing. This happened to two separate apps at exactly the same time, and there's no indication that any of the network drivers have failed or anything like that. To be honest, I've been looking for a reason to nuke and pave this laptop to really clean out 3 years worth of crud and apps that I don't use. I never had to do it on this computer, so it's built up a bit. Thought I'd see if you two had any thoughts on it, though, before I go medieval on it. Well, it sounds like going medieval after several years is not a bad idea, but...
That's my vote.
Well, let's talk about what nuke and pave is going to do, right? There's some things that we can try beforehand. And of course, I promised we'd mention Onyx again, and here's the opportunity. That's the first thing I would do is launch Onyx, clean out the caches, clean the permissions. One of those two could be doing it. The other thing that could be doing it is you might have a damaged virtual memory swap file. These are in some cases recycled from session to session, even after you reboot. So
really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. The best way to delete.
Are you sure? I thought a reboot kind of reset the VM space.
Sometimes the files are recycled.
Okay.
And what you can do is you can run Applejack. So you have to install it and then boot into single user mode by holding down Command S while the computer starts. And then if you run Applejack, you can delete the virtual memory swap files. This will ensure that you're not getting those. So that would be kind of the first two steps. Reinstalling remote desktop client seems a pretty obvious thing. Delete it, maybe even delete the preferences, and then go into home library preferences and delete anything to do with remote desktop. Also go into application support, home library application support, and delete anything there. And then, you know, I'd try the 10.5.6 combined updater. I'm trying to
Dude,
think.
You're
of,
hardcore, man.
Well, nuke
and pave. You're nuking and paving.
No, nuke and pave is format and start.
Well,
again.
But this is close.
Hmm.
You
well, that's exactly
everything.
It.
Everything that's part of the problem,
right?
Potentially,
that's the idea, isn't it?
Yep.
What else do you do? Do you have any ideas?
No.
Okay. Then we'll do this. We've
it's been
rambled.
An hour.
We've answered questions. We've shared tips. We've shared stories. It's been good.
We've shared a bit of ourselves. And so have you. And
that's the point. We appreciate that. Yeah.
I feel a kumbaya moment here. No?
I was letting them sing.
We're not going to hold hands and...
iPhone
maybe,
Alley.
Go ahead. Maybe at the next Macworld.
We'll have a Mac Geek Gab kumbaya moment. So, did we mention this? Have we talked about the fact that Macworld moved to February?
Oh, February. I'm a bit indifferent. I mean, January was the start of my vacation year, so though the weather kind of sucked, so delaying it a bit may be good. Well, for the Northeast, though, Dave, I don't know.
I think it's fantastic.
Okay, why?
Because it means that
and CES separation.
Yeah,
is that it?
Yeah. So there's the CES separation, but even more than that. You know, what's happened now, especially as it's kind of crept back up to basically the first weekend of the new year, is it, you know, what happens is December 15th, everybody sort of kind of starts disappearing from their desks. But trying to coordinate stuff for Macworld, you know, you're trying to reach people when they're not quite reachable. And it really sucks. It kind of, you know, diverts a lot of attention away during the holiday season and all that. So to be able to move it out 6 weeks after the new year, we don't have to do any meeting scheduling or any of that until after we all come back from being away for a week for Christmas and New Year's. So I think it's fantastic. Plus, it allows companies right now, you know, if you've got a product that you could release in November and maybe get some Christmas sales from, if you're a Mac company, you're hanging onto that product until Macworld Expo so you can get some splash. Now, you're going to release that product before, you're going to get Christmas sales, and then you're going to have, you know, maybe your 0.1 update in February, you know, middle of February. So I think it's about the best thing that's ever happened. And some of the vendors that I've heard from definitely agree. So
No, actually, you know, you're right, because the hustle I had to do, you know, I usually do some sort of scheduling. You got like a week where everybody's dogpiling you with invites, and it's so I think it offers a bit more breathing room for just having a well thought out and organized event. Cool.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's good. All right, iPhoneAlley.com is Michael Johnston's home. He's the one that converts this show to AAC for you. CashFly.com is where you find out more about the company that provides all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Audible, one free book, available at audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. You got anything else to say, John?
No.
Well, then that's that, isn't it?
Sorry.
No, that's definitive. I like straight answers. We don't waste time. We don't screw around.
And you don't get caught.
Did I tell you in the airport?
What?
I didn't get caught.
Made up.